Session number 10203, Rio 6.
Mr. Nunnally, Rio 6.
It was the only voice and the only accent in the English language that he'd ever heard, so naturally he had to copy it. It was a very strange, eerie experience, really. Tomasi came from the shores of Lake Victoria and was a Luo tribesman, the Luo being one of the biggest tribes in East Africa. He was an exemplary personal servant. We got on very well together. He kept my clothes and uniform in excellent order. We went everywhere together. At one stage, I was back in Kenya, and I got an eye infection. And I must just say that, talking about the loyalty of the individual, what had happened, first of all, to lead up to that was, I was driving a 1,500-weight truck from Abyssinia down to Nairobi, and it's a pretty rough road. On the rifle clip on the passenger side of this 1,500-weight truck, I'd hung my canvas bucket containing the odd bottle of whiskey, the odd bottle of gin, and so on. Of course, there was no glass in the windows of these trucks. And we went over a bump, and the whole bucket flew off the rifle clip and disappeared through the open window of the truck. Quick as a flash, Tomasi opened the door and launched himself after it, even though I was still running. I heard a terrible scream as I came to a stop, and there was Tomasi lying in the road, and the rear wheel of the truck had passed over the back of his knee. He was in terrible pain. It was obviously very serious indeed, and we were hundreds of miles from medical assistance. The problem was that if I turned and tried to get back to Addis Ababa, I'd be going through very wet country with a lot of mud, which had impeded our progress. On the other hand, it was a greater distance by far to go across the Chalbi Desert through the northern frontier district looking for medical assistance. I was a member of a very small convoy, so I decided, with the approval of the convoy commander, to take a second truck to accompany me, and we would race ahead as fast as we could to get Tomasi to medical assistance. Put him in the back of the truck. He went pretty grey, as Africans often do when they're in great pain and ill, and it was not a nice sight. And of course we had to lurch over these awful roads. Well, we went on through that part of Abyssinia, and everywhere I looked for any medical assistance, there was absolutely nothing at all. Even some occupying district commissioner who had got a flag, British flag flying at his outpost, could offer no help. So there was nothing for it but to go down the escarpment leading from Abyssinia to the Chalbi Desert, which is a very rugged place, to say the least, and keep heading south. The point of this story is that I eventually got him to Nanyuki Hospital after numerous adventures and left him there. I went on to Nairobi, which is, I suppose, I can't remember, about 80 miles south of Nanyuki. And whilst there, I was transferred from the 3rd 6th to the 11th KAR. I also developed an eye infection, which, not serious, but it made it impossible for me to see temporarily. So I'd lost contact with Tomasi. I'd left him in hospital, and I'd transferred from the unit. Tomasi, it transpired, when he recovered sufficiently, had travelled on to Nairobi, asking any officer if he knew Bwana Nunnally, The answer was invariably no. He then made his way back by hitching lifts on army vehicles back to Abyssinia, back to Somaliland, looking for me. Then learned I'd been transferred to the 11th KAR. He then retraced his steps by the same means and eventually found me at the 11th KAR. I thought that was pretty good. But that was by no means the end of it. So we stayed together. When we were about to embark for Burma from Ceylon, an order came out that all personal servants must either enlist as askaris and become competent soldiers with basic military training given to them, or they must return to East Africa, where they would doubtless seek other employment. In a way, it didn't surprise me that Tomasi was one of the four personal servants who elected to become askaris. So we went to Burma together. I refused point blank to take him on any patrols, whether reconnaissance or fighting or into any action at all. He got a bit of rifle musketry training, but it was very rudimentary, although he's keen as mustard. And he kept pleading with me, because he was adventurous and full of fun, and I kept on refusing, and we had a few quarrels about it, which naturally I won. Then I began to develop one of those silly reputations for being lucky. And I was given a nickname, because these Africans always give you nicknames if they can possibly find one which is appropriate. And he told me after one of these patrols or actions or whatever it was, that my nickname was now Bwana Moto Sana, which is, in short, Bwana Very Hot Stuff. I fell about laughing. I didn't feel particularly hot stuff. I just felt very lucky. And he said, I want to come with you the next time you go out. Well, a most unfortunate series of events then began to unfold. Whilst on detachment to the 4th KAR with the platoon, the rifle platoon and the intelligence section, I had done my little stint, and it was the turn of the platoon commander and his platoon to go and consolidate a forward position to which the 4th company would then advance and occupy about 3 miles south. Lieutenant Charles Mann was the platoon commander, and he was a reinforcement officer, a newcomer to the 3rd 6th. In retrospect, it was a great mistake that the commanding officer of the 3rd 6th should have sent a reinforcement officer out. He should have sent a more experienced subaltern with me to command that platoon. Anyway, I was in the Ugandan's perimeter when later that day I heard shouts and the noise of booted feet, and the platoon from B Company, the 3rd 6th, was running in total disorder back into the perimeter. They had thrown away their arms Many had thrown away their equipment, and the last person to return was Lieutenant Mann. It transpired that they had been ambushed by the troops that I had myself been stirring up on my patrols. And surprised in this way, close quarter firing by the Japanese, the Africans had simply panicked and they'd left their officer. Mann was in a state of total shock. He had tried to rally the troops, had failed, and he found himself completely alone. It was the first time I had ever seen a man in a state of total shock, and it was not a pretty sight. We laid him down and he was shaking uncontrollably and demonstrating all manner of symptoms of total uncontrollable shock. And he was evacuated. I never met him again. He never returned to the unit. My predicament then was quite obvious, that an attack had to be made by the 4th Force. The 4th Force, being Ugandans, would scorn and scoff at the Tanganyikans for running. I had to uphold the honour of the battalion. I simply could not permit a situation to be created where it was said that the Tanganyikans of the 3rd Six were cowards. I knew also that I couldn't rely upon the platoon askaris of Lieutenant Mann's, and I must use the intelligence section, who after all knew me very well. So sure enough, it was decided by the company commander that he would lead an attack without delay. The time now was getting on a bit, probably about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I suppose, which was fairly critical. So I saw him and said that in view of what had happened with Mann's platoon, I must ask to lead his company's attack with my intelligence section and thus redeem the honour of the Tanganyikans and the 3rd Sixth in particular. And he agreed and we began to prepare, face blacking and all the rest of it, last cleaning of weapons and oiling and all the rest of it. And then Tomasi asked once again if he could come with me. And I said, yes. I said, but you will remain within 5 paces of me at all times. You will be behind me 5 paces. Not 10, 5. And you will do whatever I do. Well, I led this company. I was number 2, leading scout and myself, and we got about 3 miles to go, I suppose. Started off on the track, swung off it through rather rough jungle to the east, made our way with the whole company following us, and the intention was to try to get behind the Japanese, who were at a chong or river. That's C-H-A-U-N-G, and Burma's riddled with chongs or streams or rivers of this small kind. Well, I made a mistake by miscalculating exactly where we were, because it's featureless jungle. And in fact, intercepted the track again at the point where I could see the equipment and arms of the thrown down by the askaris of Mann's platoon as they fled. We approached the Chong, and everything seemed quiet and normal. Then Private Michiko, who was the leading scout a few yards ahead of me, began to wade the Chong, which was pretty full because it was monsoon time, or just coming to the end of the monsoon. As he did so, the Japanese, occupying the other bank, opened fire. There was no alternative but to rush forward and join Michiko and hide under the overhanging bank on the side occupied by the Japanese. And another askari joined me. I don't know how he got there, but there were three of us under the bank. Tomasi, being five paces behind, was just too late to cross the river. I should stress that this was not a wide river, it was probably 25 yards wide, and it was wadeable. Well, you can imagine that the Japanese were pretty angry to find that there were three men under their very noses. And they couldn't get at us with conventional fire because we were hiding under the bank. So we opened fire by dodging up and down the bank and shooting into them and lobbing grenades. And spent our time hoping that the company attack would be put in, which would then relieve us from our situation. But time went by, and it does take time to mount an attack. And it was getting very uncomfortable, to say the least, made worse by one of those ridiculous equipment failures of the British Army. I mentioned earlier that I was armed with a Sten gun. I also had a 38 revolver, but my proper weapon was a Sten gun. A Sten gun has a magazine of about 29 rounds, and it's a rather long affair. The only way to stow spare magazines was to put them in the Bren gun magazine pouches, which were basic equipment on the webbing you wore. And all my spare magazines were in the Bren gun pouches. In the headlong rush across the river under fire, I suddenly discovered, as I was reaching to reload my Sten, that most of the magazines had fallen out and were now lying in the bottom of the river. That made life a bit more uncomfortable and uncertain, to say the least. Meanwhile, we were getting rather short of grenades, and the enemy were making a hell of a racket by screaming, "Banzai, Banzai," and all the rest of it, as is their custom. Then a grenade came over, and one of the my two companions was wounded in just above the eye. Was obviously in no fit state to continue much longer. Meanwhile, the Japanese were trying to get at us, and by this time I was down to my revolver. The Japanese wormed his way unwisely to the lip of the bank, and I was able to shoot him with my revolver at point-blank range. I knew he'd be followed by others. And I sent the wounded man with the unwounded askari down our side of the bank to try to cross where they wouldn't come under fire and get back to our own troops, while I gave them covering fire. It is extraordinary how lonely you can feel when you are within inches of the enemy and they know you are there and there's very little you can do about it. I kept on waiting for this company attack to go in. Time was getting on, and I was lurking under that bank in increasingly difficult circumstances for what seemed an absolute eternity. And then the Japanese began to realize that if they showed their faces, they'd probably get shot. Therefore, they began to just gently toss grenades over the edge of the bank. A number of them exploded harmlessly. Then I watched one, and I knew perfectly well that something was going to happen to me. It just was one of those things. The grenade landed on the stones a few feet away from me. There was an orange flash. I was crouching down. There was an orange flash as I faced this grenade, and it exploded. The next thing I knew was a tremendous blow in the legs. Part of it was the blast, but part of it on the other leg was grenade. Because I didn't realise how badly hurt I might be. But I did think that the next grenade would probably get me anyway. So I couldn't afford to waste any more time, and I didn't think that I could actually make my way down the bank and then cross at a place of perhaps greater safety. So I thought, well, they say the Japanese are bloody awful marksmen. I better take my chance. So I fired one or two more revolver shots in the general direction of the enemy, and then got into the water and waded as fast as I could, which was not very fast, to say the least. And the whole of the water surface erupted. Incredibly, they're such bloody awful marksmen. Although the water was going up like fountains on both sides of me, nothing hit me. And I hauled myself up on the other bank and threw myself flat. I was under some bushes, and the dripping of water from the monsoon had caused the dripping of the water from the leaves of these bushes to cause a little depression in the earth. And I lay in that. And every time I moved, the Japanese could now see me, but they couldn't quite get me. But every time I moved, leaves disappeared off the bushes just above my head to the sound of fire. Meanwhile, my leg was feeling distinctly uncomfortable. Meanwhile, also, there was no attack going in. I thought, well, before it's too late, I'd just got my revolver and I drew my machete. So I kept on imagining that I could hear the Japanese wading across from further down the river to get me. I kept hearing funny sounds, like people wading or footsteps or something, despite the occasional noise from the 4th KAR. So I shouted as loud as I could, "I'm on your side, give me covering fire." The 4th opened up with guns just blazing away. I jumped to my feet and threw myself through the jungle. And that was the end of that, except that Tomasi, who had tried to follow me, was unfortunately shot and killed. Now, the corollary or the sequel of the story is that his grave was seen by... I was evacuated. His grave was seen by the trackside by a medical officer who knew him as my personal servant and recognised the name on the wooden cross that had been temporarily erected. So I knew that his body would be recovered in due course by the Imperial War Graves Commission. Some years ago, very recently in fact, I wanted to be sure that his name was... That's why I wanted to know exactly where his grave was. I wrote to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, as it's now called, and asked, and I got the most disturbing reply that there was absolutely no trace whatever of Tomasi ever having existed. This upset me greatly. I persisted, and when I was on a trip to Kenya about the same time, I asked my friend Major Sinclair, who had been my predecessor as adjutant, to assist me by applying to the Kenyan army authorities for any information. Eventually, after denials that Tomasi ever existed, his name was found to be amongst those with no known grave inscribed on the Rangoon War Memorial. And his next of kin had received the sum of 600 shillings, 600 Kenyan shillings, as the payment for his death. I think that speaks of 2.5 years, 3 years, of great personal loyalty and friendship towards me by an African. And I think that sort of story is repeated time and time again, and an example to those who believe that these people are just mercenaries. Would you not agree?
Indeed, yes. I think whilst you were with African troops, there were two famous personalities that you came across personally. Can you tell me about them and what impression they made on you?
I'll certainly be able to tell you the details of one of them. I mentioned these Ngomas, the dances that units of the KAR hold, where they brew their beer several days ahead, ferment it and get it all ready for a great dance. They prepare the meat that's going to be roasted, and then the Europeans withdraw to leave the dance to the Africans, and this will start in the at dusk and go on through the night, right through the night, and they excuse duty except for essential duties all the next day. So it's a real binge, real booze up. These Africans have a very strict code of seniority amongst the organisers of the Ngoma, and in the case of the 3rd, 6th and doubtless